He's ready. I just sent a new book to my publisher on Wednesday by email. And this is the last poem in the book. Study in white, black, and tartan. Barcelona, Easter 2009. 1. I saw Jesus today on the Rambla. He was waiting for Judas to kiss him, while a man stroked woman on stilts, stalked up and down, coattails flowing. I wondered if I could be Judas, so I tiptoed up to white-clad Jesus, looking to see who was following me. I needed someone to betray him to, an off-duty diplomat, an ex-policeman, a lesbian nun. But all I saw was a family of coke-drinking dwarves who stood back staring at me as I went forward and gave Jesus the high five. And he made the sign of the cross in my forehead, applauded by the stilt creature, sending me off for a Catalan wine. 2. It wasn't that easy to track down. It took a wandering, hour-long hunt. Then amid all the cheap Rioja, I found a bottle of Flor del Grialo, after which I fell asleep in the car that rode the cable above Montjuic to the castle I never entered. Instead, woke to return to the Rambla, where a devil was waving his black wings, shaking his horns, his hairy ankles, with no sign of Jesus at all, only a tiny dog in a tartan coat and red shades, beneath a man in the same tartan, sending me to my hotel room to curl up and pray for all the dwarves and persons on stilts for anyone who wished to be Jesus.
By Ali and Amari, called Calendar. Ever since we hung this calendar, the wall has been oozing blood. These days are a necklace, each one pierced through the middle. How can you expect us to write for coming generations? How can we pour our memories into days that have holes in their hearts? The second one is by Salman Dawood Muhammad, Unarmed Mourning. Where do I get a falcon to rule the grandeur of the road, or a hand to harvest the rabbits from the garden of the skull? Even the lakes, so well behaved in the morning, gleam while flying at noon. I wonder, does time wear a shirt dabbed with dust? Does it fall from autumn's pedestal on purpose? Or do we merely heap up holes like a fallen soldier in an ebony box? Transformers car's division of the heart, disrupting our connections, as we chop between the whip and the reward towards a bastard splendor. I wonder who will save my greeting fingers from the curse of the buffoon. I wonder who will beckon. Thank you.
Thank you, Gina. We have Miriam Casey. Miriam.
Not Marion Casey.
She's outside.
We love Mary and Casey soon. But now we have David Rowe. David Rowe. So-called advanced civilization will descend upon a so-called primitive one. And then when the war is over, say, they vacate, and the natives will try to induce their return by recreating the technology that brought them to begin with. So that's known as a cargo cult. The cargo cult of my backwards heart leads me to believe it's all real simple. Just go and hack away the tall weeds and brambles to clear the old runway. Next, illuminate its length with plastic jugs of lightning bugs. Then, climb into the control tower of discarded cardboard, put on coconut shell headphones and wait for her, the young lady with a precious stone hung from her navel and portable pedestals upon her feet, to arrive aboard the shiny silver bird with her world's store of grace and bounty ready once more to ruin me. This is to Ray Charles. You might remember when he died, Ronald Reagan, of all people, died right after him and stole all of his praise and grief. So in New Orleans, we have what you call a second line, and roughly that's it's a parade, the first line being everyone that's supposed to be there, and the second line is everybody else. And what else can I tell you? Let's see. So we went from St. Augustine's Church, and we marched to the Dewdrop Inn, an old juke joint. Brother Ray, R.I.P. Day, while the misguided rest of the nation mourned the loss of Ronald Reagan, we sure disturbed us some peace, hey. We sure stopped some New Orleans traffic in your name, Ray. From out their shotgun shacks along the raucous route, shot girls in hair curlers and slipper-shod kitchen beauticians, their men pouring good booze out onto the streets for you. Japanese tourists accosted a dancer dressed in your obituary to learn the import of tasseled umbrellas of Zigaboo, and kids who knew you only as a soda pop salesman, a talk show guest, a singer of ballpark anthems, second line two and three to a BMX, behind the empty mini piano coffin of carnations, and the Black Men of Labor SAPC, the brass band's tuba assaying mightily to rev like a muffleless motorcycle engine until we, all of us, ended up at the Dewdrop Inn, our funeral parade done, reenacting your career's progression from church to juke joint, from Sunday morning back to Saturday night. Yeah. Thank you.
homeless in Mexico is just called fuck.
Man, oh man, oh man, all day you struggle all day long. Maybe make yourself a big-ass things to-do list and get it all done. Congratulate yourself every time you pass a cantina and don't go in. Pick up a book or two at the bookstore, only to fall asleep that night and dream about her. And then when you run into her, of course she's never looked better. And it's because she's not with you anymore. And it's because she's not with you anymore. And Jesus the surfer is teaching her to walk on water, baby, and even walks her dogs. And after all, you dumped her because she cut all her hair off. It would only wear flip-flops, she reminds you, as if that made it any easier. Thank you. Thank you, David. Is that Miriam Casey? I see. There. Miriam.
I think it was
Miriam Casey.
The woman sat in the doorway, thinking all she wore in the Victorian twilight, with a huge and very graceful fan. Her face wore the time of another world, the pressure of the glimmering light that portrays the length of human relationships and human truth. The man passed by the doorway with the ladies on their arms, but none would go within 20 paces of her. She was like a beautiful piece of a masterpiece, and the light was down, and the men watched. They watched her every move as they chatted to their lady friends, and took their pleasures in the room prepared for such adventure. There were many rooms set out. There was the room of play, the room of dance, the room of beauty, the room of charm. The room vibrated with chatter and gossip. The men were filled with generosity of spirit as they clamped for it, and bestowed all their attention and favour on the beauty on their arm. Then with giggles and much frivolity they smiled, and touched and felt the place of the pleasure. They descended the stairs, flushed with exertion, and the joy of their enchantment, music played, sweet and teasing. The men looked to her as they descended the stairs, but there would be no contact. A huge chasm where they could not have the liberty to hold or cherish, or have her in their grasp. Just the sounds of teasing the emptiness of all that pleasure. And they never saw the flooding darkness in their eyes, waiting behind the fan. And as time went by, the men's hearts began to grow more and more part of her. They could not move without their very thoughts, they must her. They went to the rooms to perform their acts of desire and intimacy. But when they looked for signs within their lady's eyes of passion, it was only her that they could think of, and they ached for the soft and seductive control of the fan. And they wanted her. And the fan seemed to have come alive, alive in a way that no one seemed to understand. It seemed to draw them nearer, make them want to take control and have mastery, but they remained there waiting, trying to tempt some sign from the fan, and the floor seemed to slip from under them, and they were on their knees, and they felt a deep animal sense as they came kneeling towards her in the dark.
So much more so we have Shane and Harrington.
Drumslit. Come sun up, he paused at drumslit, to find the bar literally stiff. The words that he read, the voice from the dead, this horseman passed by in a jiff. The hunters. Slipped our vivid orange mooring, all around us water shimmers on a sleepy Sunday morning, while we stash away the fenders in our wake the dinghies bobbing as we square away the foredeck. Not a sinner seems to notice bar a contemplative heron on the bowsprit he is perching. That old Kelvin runs forever, she's the sweetest in the harbour, not too smoky when she's warm, with a thirst that's rather meagre. Let me see her fancy tackle, must have cost a pretty penny, it's the latest carbon fibre. Skipper's busy in the wheelhouse with a glyph to Jackie Dory when I fix my autopilot. We can plot the sharpest course to find your promised destination. It's the graveyard of a U-boat. Take the wheel and navigate to Bullman Marker in the distance. Look for cotton, frantic mackerel, or an isolated haddock. Don't say no to brilliant turbot or a shoal of migrant tuna. Everybody let me know if you see bait divining gannet on that spartel off by water. We can fathom out the places where they congregate and linger. Harold Sturman for a moment, that's the signal. Action stations. Ready weapons for the swordfish. Kill the engine. Swelling silence is so eerie. Then the plaintive ring of clear and present danger. As the clapper bonds the bastion, the casting cause our bulbous bowway of rocks, a buoyant apparatus chained and shackled over bladder rack, a haunt of inshore ling and conger. Telltale bubbles as each spiral sinker tears a length of catgut from a surgeon's screaming ratchet. Gather round, we said the bosun, gonna tell a fishy story while we're holding our position. Not too closely pointed, someone in a welter of excitement, with the angle of the dangle nylons almost sure to tangle. Here be scary monsters lurking if we hook a longer fellow, and the last end of the record would be broken, we'd be famous. Here's a summer school of anglers on our oceanic mission. Now the merry whistling kettle mimics jet tails off to starboard. Never mind the footsie index, hear the hoochie coochie rhythm gently lapping past our transom. Hope a tasty tidbit won't be stolen from my spinner, leaving empty lures as unproductive as the barest bottom section of topless, buttless mermaid.
All the way from Phoenix, Arizona, I think, is Niall McCarthy.
There's a slang word in Cork, haunted, and it kind of means the opposite of haunted. It means you're really very, very lucky. Like you might say, I was haunted not to get knocked down by the bus there. So the title of this is Haunted. All right. I met her in the early hours of last Saturday morning as I trespassed the battlements of Charlesport. She looked like no other woman I've ever seen. Her beauty was as timeless as the crash of the waves on the old head. Her gaze was as cool as the air coming off the Atlantic on a clear morning in Summer Cove, and her footsteps were as quiet as wings of the cormorant hovering over their watery prey in Kinsale Harbour. None of these things surprised me. Not her timeless beauty, not her cool gaze, not the sound of her footsteps. For as you know well, the white lady that haunts the Charles Fort battlements in the rocks below is the ghost of a young woman who took her own life on what would have been the happiest day of her life, in that very spot approximately 130 years ago. What did surprise me, and what surely would have surprised you too, was what she said. This lady, this white ghost, this tormented soul, opened her mouth and said, well, what would you have expected her to say? Maybe you, like I, would have expected a moan. Maybe a cry like a banshee. Maybe over the deathly quiet on the ramparts in the early hours on that dark and eerie Saturday morning, you would have expected her to deliver a grave, haunting melody to warn away anyone like yourself who believes in unending love. Maybe you would have expected her to ask why, oh why, her father, the corporal, the commanding officer in charge of that majestic fortification, overlooking the estuary, tragically shot and murdered one of his officers, her lover, on their wedding night. Instead, I really wasn't expecting it, she remarked. Were Cork lucky to beat Limerick in the football last weekend? Lucky, says I, they were haunted.
Last call at the barrel. Now an all hail for it, Eugene.
Garda Nav Corpslaw Gunnavis Gunnavla Gunnara Misha Inner Misha to Anna Chile.
Anita.
vessel. Ask me, do I want some toast? I have my own food. A little while later, he said he is going into Worcester, our local city, on his motorbike. Do I want a lift? I sense his expectation of me. Very soon afterwards, when I'm ready, according to the timetable, I get my stuff together. I walk down a mile to catch a bus. He said he didn't want me to be a back horse with a worn-out Tesco bag, backpack, and handbag, walking down back roads. I cannot always be what he wants me to be.
We have a John Murphy. John Murphy.
After he's mown down a dozen buds or more, Van Gogh enters a new zone of attention. He'll play for hours, ignore unfinished work, congealing oils, the loaded brush that oozes yellow to the floor. His brain is chilled as frozen blood in Iceland. Avatar of Christ, avenging angel, though he knows the quest is meaningless, he sips his absinthe as he slaughters made men and prostitutes on wireframe streets and plazas. The black flames abattoirs of black flesh made cartoon flesh on the cold synapse of murder. Later he'll switch to pay-per-view, watch boxing or the UFC, his orthodox left fist forward as he jabs and hooks the surrogates of art dealers, critics, gay gangs, taking everything they've got, the low blows, the rat punches, the kidney shots, until he falls exhausted at last to the canvas.
Amen.
The one, the only, Joe Sweeney. This is another little extract from a ghost story called Aunt Emily's Secret, and two boys are sitting in a railway station. Mm-hmm. Both their parents have been killed in a car crash a few weeks before. They're going to stay as they think with their Aunt Emily. When I next look at Darren, he is sitting staring forward. He has let the sandwich drop onto the ground. Darren, I say, glaring at him. He raises his head and frowns, then raises his hand to silence me as he looks down the train track as if he hears something coming. I've had enough of this shit. I stand up and kick the remains of the sandwich onto the railway tracks. To think of the care I took preparing it this morning, I could cry myself. I don't know how long more I can keep playing father and mother to Darren. He seems to be doing everything he can to provoke me. He's so fucking selfish. When I sit down again, my fingers clench the edge of the seat and I look down the platform and notice that the couple are there again and appear to be looking at us curiously from the distance. What are you two looking at? I shout. But they don't seem to notice me. Darren stands up. Don't shout at them, he says angrily. They're creeps, I say. Besides, they didn't even hear me. It hardly seems to affect you at all, he says. You never cried once, you've no feelings, you don't care. Well, I am too hurt, too shocked to say anything for several seconds. Hold on a moment, Darren. Where did all this suddenly come from? A long disturbing silence settles between us. Dad was driving too fast, he says after a while. We both know it. You never said anything either. It's your fault too. I'm not taking all the blame. I never said you were to blame, Darren, I say angrily. There was nothing either of us could do. It was an accident. But there is truth in what he says. It's just another thing I've buried, along with all my feelings, all my grief. It's a little piece of guilty knowledge. Maybe I could have changed things if I'd spoken up. Maybe I've been so angry at Dad for driving so fast, for crashing the car.
haven't been able to feel sorry enough properly to realize that I am going to miss him forever. I haven't forgiven him, really. How can you forgive something like that? Something that kills people? Since the funeral, I've just been pushing everything away from me. There's no point in pretending, Darren Waters. There's nothing that... That's right, Darren, I interrupt. That's what I'm saying. We can't go on pretending the accident happened. Mom and Dad are gone, and there's nothing we can do about it. We've just got to move on. Silence descends between us again like a mist. That's just it, Jason, he says. I don't know how to move on. They have moved on. I can feel the hair rise on the back of my neck. Darren, I say, what are you talking about? You heard me the first time. I grab him by the shoulders and shake him. He makes no effort to stop me. It is only then that I notice how thin he is. He's lost a lot of weight since the accident. He's not been eating properly. I feel sorry for him. He's so weak. I feel terribly sorry, but angry too. I'm frightened. Darren, you'll have to stop doing this. You'll just have to accept the man that are gone. They're dead, Darren. Do you hear me? I shake him again several times, only stopping when I can see that something's terribly wrong. What is it, Darren? What's the matter? His face is deathly pale. I am frightened. I help him to sit down. Then I sit beside him, put my arm around his shoulders, regretting that I shook him so hard. Mom and Dad are not gone, Jason, he says in a distant voice. What do you mean? I say, beginning to fear Darren has been having the same dreams as myself. Even as I think it, I realize how absurd it is. How could we both have the same dream? It's simply not possible. I turn away and stare down across the tracks, trying to conceal my unease. Couple are nowhere to be seen now. I'm glad of that anyway. They were beginning to irritate me. I wonder if they went away because I shouted at them. Darren is staring ahead all sightlessly with tears welling up in his eyes. Could it be that our old home in Appleton Close was haunted? Both Darren and myself sensed it. Maybe the truth is that neither I nor Darren have been dreaming at all. Darren, I say cautiously, I need to talk to you about something. I put my hand on his shoulder. Have you been seeing Mom and Dad? He still says nothing. I can feel him shivering. He looks at me with a look of horror in his eyes. I mean, in dreams, I say hastily. Dreams? He repeats the last word of the question. It's an old technique of Darren's. He always used it in school with teachers to buy it in time so he can think of an answer. Devious Darren, one teacher used to call him. He lifts his eyes upwards over the station bridge for a brief moment as if considering, and then shakes his head and turns away, lowering his eyes to the railway tracks. Darren, I insist, standing up in front of him so he can't avoid me. Darren, what? Have you been having dreams about Mom and Dad? He looks at me and shakes his head quickly, but in that brief moment I see the glint of alarm in his eyes. You mustn't worry, Darren. They'll pass. He looks at me, his eyes blast, and I realize that my words are not getting through at all. He leans his head on his hand and drifts slowly off somewhere into his own arms. Then unexpectedly, he lifts his head and, speaking in a low, controlled voice, says, they aren't dreams, Jason. He gives me a dark little smile. Out of the corner of my eye, I see the couple moving a bit closer to us. He looks at me, almost beseechingly. You don't get it, do you, Jason? Get what, Darren? They're here, Jason.
great nature writer by the time George Pallas, who wrote a couple of tactical books in Tactics in Irishman. And in one of them he mentioned that clothes can have authority. If clothes have authority, can they also see? Do clothes keep their form and exist forever? Did a passing cloud witness Oedipus kill his father, observe Babylon slowly fall and deflate into Egypt? Here now, cloud looked down upon this ancient headland, observed the purple heather and the bark burning gold. Cloud, when you pass this way again, the sea may dazzle you and reveal your very reflection. Question you, O cloud. You are the great overseer, god of refraction. But here, things crumble, sink, vanish. You sail on, yes, just sail on. Only boats here. That's it. I was in Athens a couple of years ago and was photographed of the entrance to the city where the wagons used to go in and all the philosophers and etc. used to actually drive in. So we could forget. In the 18th century, the start of the 18th century, Cork was known as Little Athens. Okay, actually it doesn't know. We had a superyard complex. We had artists like MacLeish and Hogan, and writers like McGinn, who was the editor of Fraser's magazine in London. Croft and Croker, all these fellows. And later on there were James and Crawford, who were great patrons, and James J. Murphy there. So Cork was known as Little Athens. This is called Little Athens. We were taking photographs of the ground, the very gateway where the wagon wheels left the ruts at the entrance to the city. We put our fingers down on the shining markings, touching the very stones they passed over idly into the city. And they defended it, that city. How they defended it. Great nations from the east would not overcome it. The demons in the Agora saw to that there was power in the humble abstracta. Then rulers had the next to listen. Now it charmed. They only listened less. There was a time when my city was known as Little Athens after frustrated men had settled down elsewhere and made a difference. The benevolence of those who stayed was great. Their munificence was humble. Streets were named after them. Their charisma resonates. Now no one comes to these gates, north or south, to ask, where are your wheel marks? Where are your shining stones?
Thanks, Rob. Now let's go to Little Athens' premier poetry stage, Mary Noonan.
This is inspired by a painting by the Mexican artist Frida Kahlo. It's called Frida and the Monkeys. Frida sits on the veranda of her blue house, eyes fixed on the giant orchid poking from a stone jar before her. The flower is a buttery yellow, its fleshy outer whorl enclosing an ochre throat striped with ruby, the mouth of a cave lined with tiger skin. She sits bolt upright, her broken spinal column clamped in a steel corset that spikes her ribs. two favorite spider monkeys squat on her downy forearm, their long arms stretching round her shoulders, wizened hands cupping the back of her neck. Their mouths are fixed in a solemn mook, their black eyes, like hers, stare at the plant. Sounds of a band break over the wall. The monkeys twitch and flick their tails at the red cactus flowers. Sleeping parrots leave the shade of the jacaranda and flap at the shuttered windows as kettle drums and shrieking cornets lead a frayed gang of clowns and rope walkers into the alleyway beyond the house. Frida cannot see them, but she knows them, knows the double bass, the little bassoon and the big bassoon, the oboes and green ivory hunting horns, the bagpipes and fipple flutes, knows the caterwauling, the banging on her eardrums, knows the dwarf woman, her perfect woman-sized feet kicking and stomping and jerking the band forward. Frida closes her eyes, opens her lips, her mouth, her ruby throat. The monkeys fling themselves at the branches of the tree.
Wait,
waves to and fro, the spikes on yellow color reflects off the white wall. I see it slightly blurred, yet so beautiful. Just once it's by itself. It stops. Everything grows calm and quiet. I wait, wondering. Then it reveals itself, the daffodil of it, one single one. Suddenly I wait to find tears rolling down my cheeks. I clutch at my chest as my heart pains. It's a pain being of death and sadness. I sit and wait for it to pass and think to life. An angel at your side. A softness you can't describe, a crisp you can't explain, a touch of love your heart can't comprehend. A feeling of warmth, a feeling of protection, an angel at your side, a lifetime of fighting. Strive to live, to learn, to be you, to be born. An emotion of strength, a feeling of light and darkness, a smile when your soul is sad, an heart when you open your eyes, an angel in the sky, an angel by yourself.
We've been a strange luxury of having a little bit of time left, so is there anybody else out there who wants to come up to do a poem?
I'll read it. It's called Dogshit Road. I live in the Sunday Dwell Road, and we have a problem. We have a serious problem with dogshit. And, you know, I put up with it for a while. And, this poem is coming out in a posh magazine in Belfast called the Ulster Tatler. So all these posh women in Northern Ireland are going to be reading this poem about Cork Dogshit Road. At dawn on New Year's Day I rose, dressed in black, with a small can of black paint and a fine silver brush, out onto the street, made my way down to Annie's Gastro Pub, opposite which a sign spelled out in white on a yellow background, Sunday's Well Road. I dogged on top the new name, Dogshit Road. I stood back nodding, then loped off in search of all the other signs bearing the obsolete name. And when every one was doctored, I returned to my bed to rest for the long campaign ahead. Next day I rose even earlier to ferry a can of purple paint out to each and every pile of dog shit, around which I painted a circle, and beside this a command, pick it up, which I knew would not be obeyed. I went home and unwrapped my mail-ordered Excalibur crossbow, plucked the string, fingered the sharp bolts, looked into the telescopic sight with its crosshair that whispered dog and dog owner. Took it out to the garden to practice. When I'd hold a can of baked beans 20 times, I deemed myself ready to dish out what was coming to them. Shitters of the world, they shit allowers, flowers of carpets and tar floors, crockers of my back when I slipped bouncing a bottle of Gevrey Chambertin off the ship's shit-smeared pavement. Gevrey Chambertin, by the way, is Beckett's favorite wine. While a permed woman with a large dog walked past tutting. Well, they'd have plenty to tut about when I got going. I said to the poster of Batman above the loo. I modeled my mask on his, but forewent the cave. Instead, I'd invested in a black wetsuit, which I slipped into the lee in to test the temperature. It would do. I would need a place to lurk to bide my time until slaying. Knowing that most of the offenders took their mutts out in the dark, I bought some night vision goggles. Black, of course, and a long black wig. My first night was a full moon. I slung my crossbow on my back and prowled dog shit road. In no time at all, a fat man with a Staffordshire Terrier came prancing out of the pub. And not 10 meters away, the hound pushed out a steaming turd. I whipped my crossbow off, took aim, and unleashed a bolt straight into the canine's arse. His roar was drowned out by my howl as I galloped up a set of stairs to the next terrace. It had begun.
Matthew, you said you were rewriting part two of that ages ago. Did you not come up yet?
That's it.
On the way.
No.
That is part two.
I was told by a foreign poet, that is enough.
That's enough.
You have enough. The reader can write the second part.
From Estonia.
Yes.
There's a great series of maps on the Cork City Council website which shows the history of Cork in maps. So you always look at that. Marsh. I was all bog and bits of islands. My bird heavy mane of reed, a river of lyrical rushes. A Celtic hunter flowing his curra to the heartbeats of a wayward doe. I grew wooden bridges and jetties, towers and ramparts, huts and dirt roads, smoke rose nightly from the jewels of swords and harps. I sank heavier with merchants and markets, cobblestones, cannons kept alehouses then. Top hats and summer umbrellas nodded to soldiers and carriages, oiled street lamps lit stocks and paupers, men and metal stitched me home. to Rio with Queens about 3 weeks ago, and I was going to drive back, and I got invited to Longley's 70th surprise birthday party the next night. So I found myself with an afternoon free and a car, you know, in Belfast, you know. And so I wrote this. It's called Just Between Rivers, and it's for the Northern Poets. Some say we're cultures apart, Cork and Belfast. Offer your shadow a glimpse of the sun. Spiral outwards from the center of Giant's Ring. Meet an oak. Stop to breathe Lagan Valley stillness. A summer conversation with a capstone. From the wide rim, one brown butterfly lands its wings open. A pair of burnt orange eyes powdering fire onto the earth. Turn under shade in a slow corkscrew release from excess gravity. Head for Holywood. Drive up in County Down to peel for a red squirrel in the forest park from high up on a clearing above the lock where South Antrim Hills tease like an accent. A shrill of grasshopper stops as warmer thermals mate with branches that string bass to birdsong, float over the warm south summit and down the cushioned pathway where an aging leveled beach pulls a full mushroom tongue, welcomes you with mushroom eyes, with raised mushroom eyebrows, nose squashed to the side. I know where the red squirrels are. Here, past is lost, for what was never written. For all the times you swear, you'll remember that line. You won't forget that line. You won't forget that line. Closed eyes sway to tides of stillness. Breathe deep, silent, years dead, fears of sparks, mistaken gestures, setting the city ablaze, blistering that diatonic accent, that brother or sister in song. I've been collecting bunches of northern hellos today. How are you? They say here. Isn't the Cork accent amazing? We're just mad about the Cork accent. Funny you say that. So do we about yours, sure. Haven't we been singing the news since day dot, lilting up and down, being the bars you've always been, the old wink? The doves are onto us, sure. What do you think? Your accent is much nicer than ours, you say. Tell this to an audience of ear-prickled holly, eye-level fern, of nosing oaks, choirs, buttercups, foxgloves, Ulster daisies, and what seems a dying Douglas fir, sides split from laughing, a horsehair shed along the dung-scented slee, into forests where winds fluster in undergrowth of tangled solitudes. Even here, poisons coalesce on the tips of tongues, toxin dark imaginings, lighter in the half-digestion of messianic antidotes inside beings that have done this before and won. Pendulum down to a high stream, cool water tickles the stones. Polish forth the 65p centra, good to go. Fill the bottle from this crystal, lagging stream, and drink. Thoughts collect in rapid bloom. The naked majesty of mature elms, a half-lit green petal sky, useful shapes in deadwood, the reunion invitation of a natural amphitheater, ode to be a fairy among the lazing ferns, startled leaves where nature knows no grudge, composing arms inducting the salt of gifts of life force, death almost invisible, death barely there. Finish more of the liquid that has quenched the owners of great distilleries with this drunkenness, this free bahishka, ishka bahamor, surely more invigorating than any golden intoxication. Zenith back to Belfast, flags flicker in the sun, bright streets, for a moment lost in Langland. Unfinished skyscrapers spin past the Albert clock. Beneath, Bale Fairster no longer whispers, Dunes of Vale. Skirt around near Ormo Bridge, eat over to the Golden Mile to pick some more hellos and smiles. It's a light bar to taste, this river of kingly color, the vein aortic mix of spirit liquid and... Is that right? An oxygen of delight, this is stream of pure poetry, as even evolves vampires for the dose and blends of rich, thick contradiction of unraveled breaths, expires. And even as muses, pilgrim seasoned muses, you see the trail of purple dripping from tongue and teeth, a new harvest of mystery. And even as poets, stars, poets, sip the mountain manna, purple poem wine, dream drunk poets, all deafened, descend perfectly.